Today is Tuesday, September 15th, and this is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, a chunk of ice the size of Paris has broken off the Greenland ice shelf.
In 2019 and 2020, we've had record-breaking summer temperatures in this part of Greenland.
Also ahead, Donald Trump threatens Iran, plus the results of local elections in Russia. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Greenland, where an enormous chunk of the region's ice shelf has broken off in the far northeastern Arctic. The iceberg that broke off the N92 glacier is 110 square kilometers in size, according to satellite imagery, and has raised alarm bells among scientists who say it is evidence of rapid climate change. For more on what this means, I spoke to Dr. Jenny Turton, an expert in climate and ice at the Frederick Alexander University in Erlangen, Germany.
The glacier of interest is called the 79 North Glacier, the northeast of Greenland. For a long time, it's not really been studied because since around 2000, the amount of ice that's been lost every year is not too much. It's around 2 kilometers squared, which is around 20 football pitches. However, in 2019 and 2020, there was a huge amount of ice that was lost in these calving events, around 100, 110 kilometers squared. And that's more like the size of Manhattan Island, or for people in Europe, more like Paris or Manchester. So it's been the last 2 years that these huge amounts of ice have broken away from the glacier. And that's why we're particularly interested in it.
So did this ice all break off in the last few days, or is this part of a longer process?
It's a longer process. So half of the chunk broke away last summer, or around last summer, and then half of it this summer. And it's more of a gradual process because the sea ice starts to melt. There is less ice pushing up against the glacier to protect it. And also there's been a lot of melting on the surface, and the water drains into cracks and crevasses and kind of destabilizes the glacier edge. So it's a bit of a longer process. It's just that we've only just noticed it in satellites the last few days.
And why is this raising so many alarms?
Well, we haven't seen anything of this size from this region being lost since earlier in the 2000s, a neighboring glacier lost some of its floating ice shelf. And so now we're a little bit concerned that maybe this one is going to follow suit. I think the timing of it is also important, because this year we've had a lot of different climate change impacts that are happening, for instance, the wildfires in the States and also in Australia. And in 2019 and 2020, we've had record-breaking summer temperatures in this part of Greenland.
What might be the implications of this particular event? Will this contribute to sea levels rising?
Well, because the ice from this glacier that's broken off is already floating on the ocean, it doesn't directly cause sea level rise. But what usually happens is that the rest of the ice on Greenland that feeds into the glacier starts to speed up, and so then you're getting more ice into the ocean that way. So you get an indirect sea level rise. This glacier feeds into a fast-flowing ice stream in the northeast of Greenland, and it drains around 12% of the ice sheet. So quite a large area of ice is sort of vulnerable in this region.
As you've said, this is the result of climate change. Why is climate change impacting this glacier so much?
Yeah, so the ice shelves and the floating glaciers are vulnerable to changes in the atmosphere and the ocean. And in the last sort of 30, 40 years, we've had around 3 degrees of warming in this region, so much faster than the global average. But the ocean beneath the glacier is also increasing in temperature. So it's been attacked by sort of two different angles. And that's why the Arctic is often so vulnerable, and climate change is a little bit more obvious in this region, because it's got warming atmosphere and warming oceans.
That was Dr. Jenny Turton, an expert in climate and ice at the Frederick Alexander University in Erlangen, Germany. In the western United States, smoke from massive wildfires in the states of Oregon, Washington, and California are posing health risks, the AP reports. The acrid yellowish-green smog from the fires has contributed to what the AP reports as some of the most unhealthy air on the planet by some measurements. The smoke was so thick Monday that Alaska Airlines announced it was suspending service to cities in Oregon and Washington. In California, the fires have burned nearly 13,000 square kilometers and destroyed over 4,000 buildings. Some people who fled the blazes have managed to return to their homes, but many have found only ashes. In the town of Talent, Oregon, search and rescue teams looked for victims as families picked through the ash and debris after a fire burned their neighborhood to the ground. Lisa Bernard of Reuters produced this report.
Apocalyptic images of the town of Talent, Oregon emerged Monday in the aftermath of the Alameda Fire, one of several devastating blazes that continue to rage across Oregon, California, and Washington.
This was your home, obviously, right?
Yep, it's all gone.
Talent residents Dane and Hansel Valentine gave Reuters a firsthand look at where their house once stood, a stone chimney one of the few recognizable features among the ash and debris. Drone video showed patches of red fire retardant blanketing whole neighborhoods in Talent, block after block of homes completely burned to the ground. Search and rescue teams looked for victims among the rubble, while families picked through the scorched ruins in search of any belongings, including missing dogs and cats, with owners leaving bowls of food and water in the hope their pets would return. Tracy Koa, a high school teacher, returned to Talent over the weekend after evacuating with her partner Dave Tanksell and 13-year-old daughter. Koa told Reuters, quote, "We lost everything, but at least we have our family. Thank God we left when we did." After 4 days of brutally hot, windy weather, the weekend brought calmer winds blowing inland from the Pacific Ocean. The cooler, moister conditions helped crews make headway against blazes that burned unchecked last week. But emergency officials worried the shifting weather still would not bring enough rain to help quell the fires. Down the road from where the Valentine's house once stood, a woman with a Trump 2020 sign on her home pointed a shotgun at the Reuters journalist and shouted at him to leave, saying, quote, "You're the reason they're setting fires up here." She was perhaps referring to false rumors that left-wing activists had sparked the wildfires. Oregon Governor Kate Brown told CBS News over the weekend that drought conditions, extreme temperatures, and high winds created the, quote, "perfect firestorm" for the blazes to grow, adding, quote, "This is a wake-up call for all of us that we've got to do everything in our power to tackle climate change."
That was Lisa Bernard of Reuters. President Donald Trump visited California Monday to meet with state officials about the fires. He rejected calls from California officials to consider the role climate change plays in the historic blazes. Instead, Trump emphasized poor forest management as a cause of the fires. Scientists say both climate change and decades of poor forest management are to blame. At one point, the California State Secretary for Natural Resources, Wade Crowfoot, urged the president to acknowledge that climate change is real. Here's their exchange.
"And we're seeing this warming trend make our summers warmer, but also our winters warmer as well. So I think one area of mutual agreement and priority is vegetation management. But I think we want to work with you to really recognize the changing climate and what it means to our forests and actually work together with that science. That science is going to be key, because if we ignore that science and sort of put our head in the sand and think it's all about vegetation management, we're not going to succeed together protecting Californians."
"Okay. It'll start getting cooler.
You just watch. I wish science agreed with you."
"Hey, well, I don't think science knows, actually."
Later, California Governor Gavin Newsom shot back at Trump's comments.
"It's not even, to me, debatable. It's not a belief system. It's about acknowledging science. It's not about believing in facts or not believing in facts. Facts are facts. Science is science. It's about acknowledging the science and acknowledging the facts that the hots are getting a lot hotter. The dries are getting a lot drier. We're still struggling through the last 5-6 years where we have been in drought conditions in this state. Well, climate change is real."
Climate change is now becoming a campaign issue. Trump's rival, former Vice President Joe Biden, responded to Trump's climate change denial by accusing him of being a, quote, "climate arsonist," end quote. U.S. President Donald Trump Monday night threatened Iran with a response, quote, 1,000 times greater in magnitude, end quote, following a media report about an Iranian plot to kill the U.S. ambassador to South Africa. Iran Tuesday warns the U.S. against making a, quote, "strategic mistake," end quote, after Trump's tweet. The foreign ministry called the allegations, quote, "baseless," end quote. Iranian government spokesman Ali Rabi says in Iran's experience, statements by the United States are based on, quote, corrupt reports, end quote. He also says the style of the U.S. and Trump, quote, disturbs the peace in the region, end quote. The U.S. news outlet Politico Monday reported that American intelligence sources said Iran plans to kill Ambassador Lana Marks, a Trump ally, in retaliation for the U.S. killing of General Qasem Soleimani. A U.S. airstrike in January killed Soleimani, a powerful Iranian military leader and head of the Revolutionary Guard Quds Force. The U.S. said Soleimani had been planning an imminent attack on American personnel. South Africa's state security agency said it was aware of the report and that it is in contact with, quote, relevant partners, end quote, in the country and overseas to protect Marks and all other diplomatic officials in the country. This is VOA. U.S. lawmakers are calling for an investigation into the alleged forced sterilization of migrant women detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, agents. A whistleblower complaint published late Monday from Dawn Wooten, a nurse at an ICE facility in Georgia, alleges that doctors performed hysterectomies and other procedures on women who may not have needed the procedures. Joaquin Castro, a Democratic Party member of the U.S. House of Representatives, said he and his colleagues are investigating the, quote, serious allegations, end quote. In a statement published on the Law and Crime website, which first reported the whistleblower complaint, ICE did not deny the claims, but said it, quote, takes all allegations seriously. You are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny says he's now breathing on his own after awaking from a medically induced coma in a German hospital. Navalny was flown to Berlin after falling ill on a flight in Russia in August. A German military lab determines Navalny was poisoned with the Soviet-developed Novichok nerve agent. Russia's government denies Navalny was poisoned. On Tuesday, Navalny posted a picture on Instagram of himself in the hospital with a caption reading, quote, "Hi, this is Navalny. I have been missing you. I still can't do much, but yesterday I managed to breathe on my own for the entire day," end quote. Navalny's apparent poisoning took place in Russia's far eastern Siberia region while he was investigating corruption and drumming up support for opposition candidates in local elections. Those elections took place over the weekend and full results are now in. President Vladimir Putin's ruling United Russia Party won big across the country, but in Siberia, opposition candidates made gains. For more on the election results, I spoke to my VOA Russia Service colleague Yulia Savchenko in Washington.
So these elections in Russia are being seen as a big dress rehearsal for the 2021 Duma or Russian parliament elections. And for now, the big takeaway is that the ruling Russia Party managed to preserve most of its seats, and we know that there will be no runoff. And the United Russia Party has always been the winner in the last years in all kinds of elections. But we're also seeing several regions where there is a slight digression from this pattern, and where we see opposition members taking seats in local municipalities. And it needs to be emphasized that these regions are the regions where the work of the Russian opposition, one of the biggest opposition leaders, Alexei Navalny, took place recently. These are the regions in Siberia, and for now we know that there are three members of Navalny's organization that are taking seats in local municipalities. So this is seen as a big breakthrough and the possibility that in 2021, possibly in Siberia, the ruling party is going to be contested by opposition, and possibly there will be more success on the opposition side by the next year.
So what is so unique about Siberia that the opposition is making gains there?
It is very interesting because Siberia in the last years has seen a lot of protests, a lot of pan-opposition movement. First of all, Alexei Navalny, before his poisoning, was just there and he was filming a documentary about local corruption. As I've been talking to a number of analysts on the ground, they're just saying that because Siberia is so remote and so far away from Russia, people are starting to act more independently, and they're in Siberia in general. Central power, they're less popular than anywhere else. Siberia is a huge region, rich in resources, rich in intellectual power, because in Novosibirsk, for example, it's the third biggest city in Russia, and universities and science has always been a big factor in Novosibirsk. So people are starting to think more independently in Siberia, and Moscow is well aware of that, and that's why there are more resources that are being directed that way to kind of convince or win the people in Siberia back.
Now, in practical terms, how significant are these opposition victories?
It's more of a symbolism of this victory that people are paying attention to right now. Some voters were saying that they watched those investigation videos that Navalny and his team produced, and that's how they started recognizing these candidates and they started voting for them.
That was my VOA Russia Service colleague Yulia Savchenko in Washington. European Union Council President Charles Michel is in Greece today following the catastrophic fire that burned down the Moria refugee camp on the island of Lesbos. The EU is set to announce new migration and asylum rules on September 13th, but as journalist Catherine Field in Paris explains, the fire has so far not prompted any major changes in Europe's approach to migrants.
His statement he made when he was in Athens before going on to Lesbos was very much one to say that it is a challenge for all the member states. Does realize that the European Union has to come up with a policy. But what he did say was it's not just a problem, if you like, for the frontline states. That would be Greece, Italy, Cyprus, Malta. But it's actually a challenge for the whole of the European Union.
So he made his statement before even arriving in Lesbos to visit the migrants. What does that indicate?
It indicates that there really is no common policy. There is no one voice saying this is how we're going to go forward. All that the EU has come up with at the moment is saying that they will help Greece to deal with this issue, that they will help Greece to have accommodation put on that island, so there will be some sort of protection for the migrants who are stranded on that island. That's what that tells me. 10 EU nations have said they will take in 406 unaccompanied minors from Lesbos, but it's really only those unaccompanied minors who are finding a home in Europe at the moment. And that is here in France. France is going to take in some 100 unaccompanied minors, and Germany will take in 150.
That sounds like, despite the fire in the Moria camp, Europe is not even willing to take all the migrants from Moria, much less taking in more newly arrived people.
No, the only news which we are being given from the European Union is that they will provide financial support for the Greek government to help them to rebuild, to help put on more humane camps on that island. That's all we're hearing. That's really as far as you'll go.
That was journalist Catherine Field in Paris speaking to me earlier. Also on Tuesday, the Greek Coast Guard says the body of a woman has been recovered from the sea off the southern Greek island of Crete after a migrant boat sank in rough weather in the Mediterranean. That brings the death toll from Monday's shipwreck to 4. Greece's Coast Guard said the other victims were another woman and 2 boys ages 6 and 7. UN officials say governments that provide health care and social protections to their people, especially to the most vulnerable, will be better able to cushion the shock of the devastating coronavirus pandemic. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
No country has been spared the blows of this global pandemic. But as is the case with other disasters, UN officials say it is the poorest, most vulnerable, and marginalized members of society who suffer most from the impact of COVID-19. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet says some states have responded to this crisis by implementing human rights-based policies. She says states that have enacted policies such as access to health care to those who cannot afford it and providing cash grants, emergency food, and other essential aid to those who have lost their jobs are better able to weather this calamity. On the other hand, she warns nations that ignore the needs of the weakest members of society will face a grimmer future.
To date, some states have demonstrated deep mistrust of their people, repressing criticism, limiting freedom of information, and cracking down on the civic space. This and other human rights violations have undermined public health, as well as human rights, and the prospects of a strong and sustainable recovery.
Lockdown measures aimed at curbing the spread of the coronavirus have devastated the economies of many countries. They've had a particularly harsh impact on the poor and on the more than 2 billion people working in the informal sector. The International Labor Organization reports women are disproportionately impacted by the pandemic in terms of job losses and decrease in hours. It says others who bear the brunt of this unfolding economic and employment crisis include migrant workers, indigenous peoples, ethnic minorities, and people with disabilities. It says social protection systems are a key element in recovery from COVID-19. The World Health Organization reports the number of coronavirus cases globally will soon top 29 million, including nearly 1 million deaths. Executive Director of WHO Health Emergencies Program, Michael Ryan, notes human health and human rights are intrinsically linked. And yet, he says, access to health care in the time of coronavirus has not been fair.
It has been influenced by gender, by wealth, by age, by social class, by legal status, by ethnicity, and by so many other things. WHO supports OHCHR's consistent warnings that the COVID-19 pandemic should not be used as an excuse to clamp down on fundamental freedoms.
Ryan says the international community must work together to develop safe and effective vaccines and therapeutics for COVID-19. He says access to these life-saving products must be shared and distributed rapidly and equitably to rich and poor alike. He says their availability should not be based on the ability to pay for them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's it for our show today. On behalf of producer Nadia Taha and managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is welcome news that Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny is out of a medically induced coma and is responding to verbal stimuli, according to his doctors in Berlin. A statement from Charité Hospital warned, however, that it remains much too early to gauge the potential long-term effects of his severe poisoning. Mr. Navalny was flown to Berlin from Russia after he fell ill on a flight from Siberia to Moscow on August 20th, and after Russian doctors, at the request of his family, allowed him to be transported to Germany. In Berlin, German doctors determined that Mr. Navalny, who is a fierce critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin, had been poisoned by a nerve agent of the Novichok group, a chemical weapon developed by Russia. After the German medical experts announced their findings, U.S. Ambassador to Russia John Sullivan called for an immediate, comprehensive, and transparent investigation by the Russian authorities that holds the parties behind this act responsible. White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany described Mr. Navalny's poisoning as completely reprehensible.
Russia has used chemical nerve agents in the past, and we're working with our allies and the international community to hold those in Russia accountable wherever the evidence leads and restrict funds for their malign activities. The Russian people have a right to express their views peacefully without fear of retribution of any kind, and certainly not with chemical agents.
Emphasizing the need for collective response, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said NATO allies were united in condemning the horrific attack on Mr. Navalny and urged Russia to participate in an impartial international investigation into the circumstances of the attempted assassination and find those responsible. The G7 foreign ministers issued a written statement also calling on Russia to urgently and fully establish transparency on who is responsible for this abhorrent poisoning attack, and bearing in mind Russia's commitments under the Chemical Weapons Convention to bring the perpetrators to justice. This attack against opposition leader Navalny is another grave blow against democracy and political plurality in Russia, said the G7. We will continue to monitor closely how Russia responds to international calls for an explanation of the hideous poisoning of Mr. Navalny. Secretary of State Michael Pompeo echoed the G7 statement, saying this attack contravenes the international norms prohibiting the use of such weapons.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.